Uncovered with Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barish, a new three-part mini-series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For source sheets to accompany this podcast, visit www.elmad.pardes.org/uncovered.
This is Nechama Goldman Barish, back for the third podcast in the series Uncovered, and part two of the topic on hair covering. In part one of the podcast on hair covering, we looked at the Mishnah in the Tractate of Ketubot and learned that it was customary for the daughters of Israel to wear a head covering when they were in the marketplace. The Mishnah classifies this practice as dat yudit, giving this custom the status of dat, which can be understood to be a religious mandate for Jewish women, and not just a custom, although it does not put it into the category of dat Moshe, a category explicitly tied to biblical laws, examples of which are presented in the first half of the same Mishnah. In fact, the Mishnah lists violation of dat Moshe and dat Yudit, including, of course, head covering, as reasons for which a man is entitled to divorce his wife without paying her ketubah, or marriage settlement. The Babylonian Talmud, in the later conversation, tied the practice to a biblical source, tracing the source of women's head covering to a verse in Bamidbar regarding the sota, or woman suspected of adultery, where it stated, "Upara et rosh ha'isha," meaning, "and the priest uncovered the head of the woman," as part of the sota ceremony before she drank the bitter water. According to the Talmud, this reference from the Torah anchors the practice of Jewish women covering their heads to biblical times. The Talmud further differentiates between the minimal head covering it feels is mentioned in the Torah and an additional head covering mandated by dat yudit, understood to reflect the customs of the daughters of Israel, which added an additional head covering to the biblical requirement or practice. The Talmud concluded that the practice of an expanded head covering from the biblical to the rabbinic was widespread, and failure to comply could result in divorce without ketubah. While the main Talmudic discussion does not explicitly differentiate between married and single women, I suggested that it was possible to deduce from two other early rabbinic sources that the head covering distinguished married women from single ones in society. I was also very careful to continuously talk about head covering as opposed to hair covering, because the proof text in the Torah does not mention hair, but head. Rav Moshe Feinstein, a noted halachic authority in the 20th century, in several of his responses on the topic, notes the same distinction. Likewise, the Talmud does not specify that all hair must be covered. The following text from Tractate Brachot, Daf 24a, mentions that a woman's hair is erva. What is erva? It appears in quite a number of places in the Bible and usually means nakedness, indecent behavior, or shameful exposure. The phrase gilui arayot literally means shameful exposure and refers to sexually prohibited relationships. The Talmud states that erva may distract a man when reciting the Shema, even if the woman is his own wife, and it is therefore forbidden. I will now read the text in Brachot. Rabbi Isaac said, "Tefach b'isha erva," a handbreadth exposed in a woman constitutes erva. The Gemara then asks, "Lamai, in which way? What way?" Ilay malis takulebat. If you say it is to gaze at the uncovered tefach, v'ha'amar Rav Sheshet. We already have Rav Sheshet saying, "Lama mana hakatuv tachshitim shebachutzim tachshitim shebifnim." In other words, in a list of ornaments worn by women that's mentioned in the Torah, it enumerates ornaments worn outside the clothing, like a necklace or a bracelet, with ornaments worn inside what's called a kumez, which apparently was some sort of internal piercing on the female sexual organ. And by juxtaposing bracelets and necklaces with the kumez together, Rav Sheshet suggests that the Torah is already telling us that there's equal opportunity for sexual thoughts when staring at a necklace or at this internal ornament. To tell you, what does the Gemara conclude? If one gazes at the little finger of a woman, it's as if he gazed at her secret place. That's why the Torah juxtaposes this series of jewelry, one next to the other. Is that what it's coming to say? Asks the Gemara. In other words, when we say tefach be'isha erva, is it talking about just staring at a woman? Well, we already know Rav Sheshet is concerned about staring at a woman. Because if you stare at a woman, you may come to have sexual thoughts, even if you stare at a woman fully clothed, wearing ornaments like a bracelet and a necklace. It might be like looking at her kumez. No, the Gemara concludes, it can't just be to warn away from sexually gazing at women. It must be that when Rav Yitzchak said, Tefach b'isha erva, b'ishtov l'kriyat shma, it was not a blanket concern for sexual thoughts against all women. This specific statement of Rav Yitzchak was about kriyat shma and about his wife. In other words, the halachic implications here, if there are any, of Rav Yitzchak's statement is that a man during Kriyat Shema needs utmost concentration and he might even be distracted by his own wife's uncovered self. And not a lot of uncovered flesh, but really even a tefach, a hand's breadth. In other words, he should really cover his eyes and focus on his prayers while he's saying Shema. What the Gemara then does after it comes to that conclusion is it then brings three separate statements by three different Amoraim that it imports from somewhere in the rabbinic stratosphere in order to think about other sources of erva regarding the body of women. Amar Rav Chista Shok B'isha Erva, so we already saw this in the podcast I did about pants, that the thigh of a woman is erva, and quotes Yeshayahu, Galei Shok Ivrei Naharot, this idea of a bare your thigh wade through rivers as it is in Isaiah. Your erva will then be uncovered. Shmuel says, kol b'isha erva, and he quotes a proof text in Shir HaShirim, ki kolech arev umarech naveh, right? Your voice is comely and your appearance is attractive, or your voice is sweet and your appearance is comely. And finally, Rav Sheshet says, se'ar b'isha erva, as it is written also in Shir HaShirim, se'arech ke'eder ha'izim, your hair is like a flock of goats, which I've never fully understand because why would attractive hair be like goat's hair? But okay, we'll just have to assume that the reference is appropriate for the time in which Shir HaShirim was written. As I noted in the first podcast of the series regarding women wearing pants, this Talmudic text is often taken out of its context and presented as an absolute halachic statement regarding the objective, prohibitive nature of various aspects associated with a woman, her leg, her hair, her voice, as well as the idea that even a hand's breadth uncovered is nakedness. As I interpreted in the first podcast, the context in this chapter of Brachot, in its entirety, has to do with the permissibility of a man saying Shema in front of any source of potential distraction, nakedness being one of them. The major halachic codes continue to discuss nakedness in the framework of the laws of Kriyat Shema. As I concluded in that first podcast, the modesty requirements before a man reading the Shema prayer were expanded to include any public space. We end up using the laws of Kriyat Shema to create a dress code for the daughters of Israel in order to sanctify all space as if it is sacred space. In this podcast, we are going to focus the concept of erva. We're going to focus on the concept of erva, or nakedness or shameful exposure, as it pertains to the hair of a woman. Later, we will move on to integrate the concept of dat yudit, the custom of Jewish women, with erva. It should be noted that while hair is called erva, or nakedness in the source that we are about to unpack, the Mishnah in Tractate Ketubot, with its mandate for dat yudit, as discussed in the first podcast on hair covering, does not use the word erva at all. And erva was not even mentioned as a relevant concept in the Talmud's discussion about the head covering practices of the daughters of Israel. The statement by Rav Sheshet that hair is erva and must be covered when a woman is in view of a man reciting the Shema appears only once in the entire Talmud. It is not repeated or referenced anywhere else in either the Babylonian or the Jerusalem Talmud. Nonetheless, in my opinion, it has become the dominant halachic construct used in today's discourse over hair covering. The statement in the Talmud is straightforward, and there is no further discussion. Rav Sheshet does not specify how much hair need to be uncovered for it to be considered erva. Nor does he specify whether both married and unmarried women have to cover their hair for a man to say Shema. We therefore must turn to the halachic discourse in the Rishonim, interpreters of halacha, who lived between 1000 and 1500 CE. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, who lived in the late 13th century, determines the halachic definition of erva in his commentary on Brachot. He writes as follows: her face, hands, and feet, and her speaking voice, not her singing voice, and her hair outside of her tzama, meaning her veil, that is not normally covered, are of no concern because he is used to them and they will not distract him. End quote. What the Rashba does here, which is then echoed by other Rishonim, like the Ra'avad and the Ritva, is to assess the halachic category of erva in light of accepted norms of dress. In other words, not all of a woman's body is erva, even during the saying of Shema. Only areas that are normally covered must not be exposed. Additionally, the Rashba reveals that the practice in his time was for women's hair to be covered, but not completely covered, because some hair was revealed outside of the veil, and that part of the hair would essentially not be erva during the reciting of Shema. This concept that parts of the body that are customarily revealed, and likewise a woman's regular speaking voice, are not erva during Kriyat Shema, is an important one for our purposes and suggests a degree of subjectivity when determining what is considered erva, depending on the surrounding cultural norms. We will explore the implication regarding a woman's voice in erva further in a future podcast. We see the two conversations about erva and dat yudit coming together in a question asked of the Maharam Alashgar in the 15th century. The Maharam, Rabbi Moshe, the son of Yitzchak Alashgar, was born in Spain, lived in Tunisia and Greece, and served as a judge in Cairo. He died in Jerusalem in 1542. He is asked about women in the community who have begun uncovering some of their hair, and whether the community has to protest this situation, because after all, hair is nakedness. In the response, the Maharam Alashgar gives a clear description of how much hair has escaped from the veil, and he reassures those who ask the question that, in the manner of the Rashba, hair that is normally uncovered does not fall under the category of erva, even for Kriyat Shema. He quotes the Aruch, Rav Natan, the son of Yechiel, who lived in the 11th century and studied with the last of the Gaonim, who describes in his book that when a woman wrapped up her hair, she would leave some out between her ears and forehead, opposite the sides of her face. 400 years later, the Maharam notes that women still do the same, wrapping their hair and leaving hair on the sides descending over the face. He also describes how women used perfume and fine oils to comb the hair extending past the veil. He concludes by quoting the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, in ruling that if a person goes from a place where there is stringency over a certain practice to a place where there is leniency over said practice, one could act in accordance with the custom of the new place where they currently reside, although it is more lenient. The Maharan extends this concept to hair covering and specifies that if a woman goes from a place in which the custom was to cover all of the hair to a custom where to a place where the custom is to allow the hair to extend from the veil and frame the face, then women should be allowed to act in accordance with the custom of the place where she currently resides. He does not see that hair is erva because it reflects the accepted practice of women regarding hair covering. To summarize, two important points are explained by the Rashba and the Maharam. The first is that the type of hair covering required depends on the accepted practice of women in that place. And the second is that hair that is normally uncovered is not considered erva for the purposes of reciting Shema. Hence, it is only hair that is normally covered that is the erva referred to in Brachot. Moving on to the Achronim, later day halachic authorities from the 16th century on, an interesting source begins to emerge as a model for emulation. This source is an agadata or a legend and has no halachic significance in the Talmud and was not referenced previously in the Talmud or in the Rishonim. In Yoma 47a, it is written, Kimchit had 7 sons, and all served as high priests. The sages asked her how she merited this, and she answered, "The walls of my house have never seen the hairs of my head." They said to her, "Many have done so without benefiting." End of text. Listen to the rabbis respond to Kimchit. They are not overly impressed with her excessive piety and do not validate it by suggesting that all women behave in a similar way. The Talmud even asks how it came to be that 7 sons all served as high priests. The position of high priest was supposed to be for life. Nonetheless, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Rama, in his commentary Darche Moshe, which is written on the Torah, writes as follows. Only in the marketplace is going bareheaded forbidden. This is in line with the standard halachic sources that we have already discussed in this podcast. But then the Rama continues. Yet it is considered modest for a woman never to reveal her hair, even at home, as we find regarding Kimchit, who was rewarded for this, end quote. This statement is remarkable. It contradicts the Talmud Bavli in Ketubot, which made it clear that women did not cover their heads at home in their courtyard. So it seems that somewhere between 600 CE in Babylonia and 1500 CE in Krakow, Jewish women began covering their head and all of their hair at home, as well as in public space. It is my suggestion that the idea of erva, nakedness, lies prominently, although not explicitly, behind the unfolding conversation. Dat Yehudit can be adaptable to a place or time, with the explicit prohibition being only not to go bareheaded into the market, and it is applicable only to the public space. Nakedness, on the other hand, is intolerable and easier to define objectively. Just as you would cover your actual nakedness in private space, so too you should cover your hair, which is equated to nakedness during the saying of Shema, even in private space. Although the Rashba and Maharam articulated the leniency around habituation, that hair normally uncovered is not erva, the Rama moves in the opposite direction and suggests that a modest woman should cover her hair, even in private space, intimating that there is something unseemly about seeing a married woman's hair. He does not codify this as a halakha. It is more of a recommendation, but the shadow of nakedness seems to me to be hovering in the background. This becomes the main thrust of the halachic conversation, and it spreads to all space, not just sacred space, as the conversation evolves. If we look at the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, also from Krakow in the 16th century, his language becomes more prohibitive than anything we have seen previously. Quote, "Leaving the hair entirely uncovered is forbidden, even if she remains in her courtyard." He reinterprets the Talmudic conversation and the Rishonim and essentially eradicates the plain meaning of the text, which suggested that in private space, including a woman's courtyard, which is outdoors, women customarily did not cover their heads. Instead, the Bach writes that the minimum of a basket, which he calls a kippah, is halachically necessary in her own yard. He then continues, "Among Jews the world over, even before the men of her household, a woman will not appear without a kerchief and head covering." End of quote. 100 years later, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, known as the Chatam Sofer, who lived in the 17th and 18th century, goes even further and writes, quote, "Since the authorities were divided and the strict view became customary, it is considered outright law, having been adopted long ago by our ancestors throughout the Jewish diaspora. As a result, a wife requires a kerchief, even in her own room, and a hat as well in a marketplace or public square." End of quote. He concedes that this is not the halachic consensus based on the Talmudic discourse or the Rishonim. And he also admits that the people have been very influenced by the Zohar. In the Zohar Naso, there is a mandate for a woman to cover all of the hair on her head, even in the innermost part of her home, in order to protect her husband and family. Exposed hair of a woman, writes the Zohar, can unleash terrible misfortune into the world and connect to powerful external forces in the spheres above that can cause harm to the world below. It is only speculation, on my part, but it seems to me that the absolute and terrifying language of the Zohar must have had repercussions in the practices of many Jewish communities who wanted to ensure divine protection from tragedy and ill will, leading to women vigilantly covering, and in some communities like Satmar, going as far as shaving their hair off completely to protect their families. Rav Moshe Feinstein in the 20th century, when asked on this topic, refers back to the Darchei Moshe, Bach, and Chatam Sofer just cited as follows, quote, "We see that Chatam Sofer required women to wear kerchiefs even in their own rooms, and he quoted the Bach, yet the Bach refers to a courtyard and open area one normally enters without permission. The Chatam Sofer, extending this to her room, is something we have not encountered. Quite the contrary, all later authorities seem to take the lenient view." Rav Moshe continues, "Coming from so great a scholar as the Chatam Sofer, the strict practice of covering the hair at home is a worthy one to follow, especially as it achieves the modesty of kimchit mentioned by the Darchei Moshe. Even so, it is clear that those who wish to be lenient should not be considered to violate Dat Yehudit, God forbid. Even a pious Torah scholar should not avoid marrying such a woman if she is herself God-fearing, scrupulously observant, and of good character." End quote. In contrast to the Chatam Sofer, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, author of the Aruch HaShulchan, who lived in the period just after the Chatam Sofer in the 1800s in Lithuania, took a completely different approach. His approach continues the trajectory of thought introduced earlier in the Rashba and Maharam Alashker, but taken much further. While the Rashba and the Maharam said that the hair outside of the veil is not erva because of habituation, since it was the common practice among women in their time to leave some hair outside the veil, the Aruch HaShulchan is dealing with a generation of women who, in accordance with the common practice of women in Lithuania at the time, stopped covering their heads and hair altogether. And he writes as follows in Hilchot Kriyat Shema, quote, "The composers of the Shulchan Aruch wrote that it is forbidden to read Kriyat Shema opposite the hair of a woman which is normally covered, even if it is his wife. But in front of unmarried women for whom it is normal to go with uncovered head, it is permitted. Let us denounce the practice which for many years, due to our many sins, has become widespread, in which the daughters of Israel have broken the fences and go about with their hair uncovered. Our great consternation about this does not help, and this plague has spread. Woe unto us that this has happened in our days. However, as far as the law is concerned, it seems that it would be permissible to pray and recite blessings in front of their uncovered heads. Since now the majority do this, their hair has the status of parts of the body which are normally uncovered, and there is no fear of lust." End quote. The Aruch HaShulchan is aware of a phenomenon that is spreading across a generation of women in Lithuania. Tellingly, his halachic analysis appears in the laws of Kriyat Shema about the status of hair as nakedness. He rules that hair no longer serves as a source of nakedness that would prevent men from saying Shema, because it has become so commonplace to see the hair of women, even married women. His protests of the practice are apparently related to the Sota or Dat Yudit piece of the conversation. However, that does not affect his halachic ruling in regard to erva and the reciting of Shema. Meanwhile, in Poland, the Chatam Sofer has stated that all of the women have taken on the practice of covering all hair all the time as law. This is a good example of how different practices and different interpretations in different communities contribute to shaping an ongoing halachic discourse. The idea that a source of nakedness can lose its status of nakedness once it becomes commonplace is reflected from the Rishonim onwards in the conversation about habituation. However, not all halachic authorities agreed, and the Mishneh Berurah, written in the 20th century by Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan HaKohen, also known as the Chafetz Chaim, remains steadfast in his position that hair is erva and it can never lose its status. He states unequivocally in the Mishneh Berurah, Laws of Kriyat Shema, that hair remains erva even if the normal practice in the marketplace is for women to uncover their hair, by comparing it to the shok, or the thigh. Moreover, women have to cover their hair from a halachic legal standpoint. There is a Torah prohibition, says the Mishnah Berurah, and in any case, Jewish women who follow Dat Moshe, note he writes Dat Moshe and not Dat Yehudit, have been careful with this law from the beginning of our history. In his code of law, he fails to acknowledge the growing phenomenon of women who are uncovering their heads, and instead focuses on the idea of a continuous chain of observance, as if all Jewish women have been doing this throughout history. The Mishnah Berurah does not make a distinction between Erva for the purposes of reciting Shema and Dat Yehudit. He has no interest in contemporary styles. As far as he is concerned, since the daughters of Israel covered their hair from time immemorial, to do otherwise is to display erva, regardless of what is considered acceptable in general society. Another great scholar living at the beginning of the 20th century, Rav Yosef Misas, a halachic authority in North Africa, who later became the chief rabbi of Haifa, wrote an important responsa in which he essentially defended halachically the practice of women in North Africa who began uncovering their hair as they did in Lithuania. In his analysis, he largely returned to the Talmudic sources. He keeps the two chains of halachic discourse, Dat Yehudit and Erva, separate, as I have tried to do, suggesting that they never really came together halachically outside of saying Shema. Finally, he admits that in all Arab lands, married women covered their hair until there was an influx of French Jewry with a communal practice of uncovering their hair regardless of prohibition or custom. He uses the second of two explanations found in Rashi on the passage in Ketubot, which I presented in the previous podcast, suggesting that the issue of head covering in public, including the practice of uncovering of the sota's head in the Torah, rests on practice alone and is not an actual biblical prohibition. This is his interpretation, which does seem to be validated by the language of Rashi and Ketubot. He then concludes that hair covering is obligatory only from standpoint of Dat Yehudit, where that is the custom. Whether one agrees with Rav Misas' conclusions or not, it reflects the increased practice of women in his time, and it is the responsibility of a halachic authority to reinterpret and redirect halachic conversation in keeping with the needs and the reality of the community and the generation. It is not fundamentally different than the great halachic leap taken by the Chatam Sofer in mandating that women cover all of their hair, even in the privacy of their own rooms. The two voices of Rav Misas and the Chatam Sofer, who lived roughly around the same time, reflect the two ends of the spectrum of halachic discourse. To this day, there are many Orthodox women whose practices reflect each of these voices. What is interesting is that in the late 19th and early 20th century, a window of halachic discourse was opening, reflecting an increasingly prevalent practice both in Middle Eastern and European countries to uncover hair. Had more major halachic authorities from across the spectrum agreed with Rav Misas, it is possible that women would not be covering their hair today outside of the most restrictive communities. It seems to me that women who stopped covering their heads and hair from the 19th century until today were both rejecting the idea of their hair being nakedness and head covering as reflecting the modesty norms of the daughters of Israel. The Ben Ish Chai in Baghdad writes, "Look at the women of Europe whose custom is not to hide themselves from strangers. Nonetheless, their clothes are orderly. They do not reveal their bodies except their faces, necks, hands, and heads. It is true that their hair is uncovered, and this custom is not really possible according to our laws, but they have a justification. They say," meaning the Jewish women say, "this custom was accepted by all women, both Jewish and Gentile, to go with their hair uncovered, similar to the revealing of their faces. It does not cause men to have sexual thoughts when they see it." These are their words to explain this custom, and we do not have an answer by which to refute it. The Ben Ish Chai in Baghdad is also seeing women coming from Europe, moving to Baghdad, who are very modest, who are interacting with men, not hiding themselves, but are exposing their faces, necks, hands, and heads, meaning their hair, and are explaining that this is the custom, both for Jews and Gentiles. There is nothing immodest, and it does not lead to promiscuity or sexual thoughts. Nonetheless, the majority of rabbinic opinion remained firm, both in the Sephardic and Ashkenazic camps, that head covering is obligatory, even as many rabbis' wives stopped covering their hair in the early to mid-20th century. The most famous was Rav Soloveitchik's wife, meaning the most famous in the modern Orthodox community. Although he never directly addressed the halachic implications of her decision, and his daughters did cover their hair in public after they were married. Rav Ovadia Yosef, who became one of the most foremost halachic authorities in Israel in the 20th century, based his approach on the Maharam Alashkar cited above and absolutely rejected Rav Masas's analysis. He wrote, quote, "Today it has become widespread practice for God-fearing women to go out with only a kerchief or hat, without a headscarf or veil, and no one makes a fuss. It thus seems that the essential concept of women covering their hair is biblical in nature and is obligatory irrespective of changes in practice and is unchanging for all time. However, with respect to the modest practices of Jewish women, we accept any established practice to be lenient. This accords with the ruling of Maharam Alashkar, who permits women in places where the practice is for all to do so, to go about with hair protruding from under their hat." End quote. One final point that needs addressing before we conclude. In this podcast, we have been focusing on nakedness and how much nakedness can be uncovered. The introduction of the wig as the ideal hair covering often confuses people. But once we have explained the influence of erva on contemporary practice, the matter becomes clear. A woman's own hair is erva. It must be covered to protect sacred and communal space. The advantage of the wig is that it covers everything. And even if the hair is beautifully set and colored, even if it is nicer than her own hair, even if it looks real, it is still covering the erva. It is a beautiful solution pandering to both rabbinic demands and the vanity of women. My feeling is that it reflects an innate understanding of female nature, similar to what we saw in Ketubot, where the Talmud understood that women would not cover their hair in their own courtyards, risking even divorce. I feel that here too the wig is a reflection of a similar understanding for those who accept the premise of the Chatam Sofer that hair is nakedness and must be covered at all times. Women must cover all of their hair, but it has to be done in a way that allows women to feel attractive, or they might refuse to do so, as the women in Lithuania, France, and Morocco did at the beginning of the 20th century. So erva becomes a dominant part of the conversation in many traditional Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities. Many women are told that their hair has become nakedness or off-limits for all but their husbands, which creates a special sexual intimacy to hair. As a result, wigs become an acceptable hair covering, even if it obscures the obvious nature of the hair covering, and in some cases makes it look like a woman is not covering her hair. The Dot Yudit piece, the identification of the woman as a Jewess, in a way that a kippah identifies a man, becomes lost by this approach. On the other hand, for those communities that follow the approach emanating from the Talmud as interpreted by the Rashba, Maharam Alashkar, and modern-day authorities, that the requirement for head covering emanating from Dot Yudit and the question of erva during Kriyat Shema are two separate issues, partial head coverings that reveal some of a woman's hair have gained preference. In an extreme expression of the Dot Yudit as kippah, or identification, many women are using minimal head coverings, such as wide headbands, to meet the halachic requirement of the kippah and Dot Yudit to reflect their status as married women. While there are almost no mainstream poskim who legitimize this practice, in fact, it seems to me that it has halachic value stemming from the Ketubot text. There is no question that the headband in many modern Orthodox communities, even those that object to the amount of hair being uncovered, identify the women as married. In that sense, the headband or bandana or baseball cap all work regardless of how much hair is actually covered. And personally, I have spoken to many women who love the idea of marking their identity, their transition from single to married, with a Jewish ritual carried out by women dating back thousands of years, but in a way that speaks to them personally, and often that means letting their hair show. In the same vein, there are women who cover their heads in public, but uncover their heads in their own courtyards, meaning in their homes and backyards, even when guests come to visit. So as we end this podcast, look around. See the myriad ways women are covering their heads and their hair. While it is a product of halachic discourse on the matter, it often reflects the customs and practices of women within their communities or families. Yudit, indeed, continues. Thank you very much for joining this podcast. I look forward to meeting again in the final podcast in the series on Kol Be'isha Erva, The Voice of a Woman is Nakedness.
Thank you for listening to Uncovered with Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barish, a podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. Visit www.elmad.pardes.org for more in this series and other great content.